Do you know Swift, Objective-C, and Java? Can you use them in tools like Xcode or Android Studio? If so, awesome. But for everyone else, there's NativeScript. It's a cross-platform framework for building native iOS and Android apps using skills you already have. JavaScript or TypeScript, CSS, and a XAML-like XML markup. Start building your dream native mobile apps today. Use the NativeScript command line interface for free, or use NativeScript in Visual Studio with a Telerik platform subscription, which will enable you to build iOS apps without the glowing Apple. Get started for free at telerik.com/nativescript.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 507. In this episode, Scott talks with Irene Ross about data visualization.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Irene Ross. She's a data visualization expert and a specialist at Boku on the topic of data visualization. So you have been doing data visualization since your entire career. This has been your focus, has it not?
Yeah, just about. I actually started being just the software engineer at IBM, and I happened to stumble into an internal talk from a group of researchers that were doing some really interesting work around a project called Many Eyes, which was kind of like a YouTube for data visualization. And I was so fascinated and excited, and because I'd never really seen data visualization before or thought about it as a discipline, it was just kind of there. And suddenly I thought, oh, I could be doing this instead. And I weaseled my way in, and that was about almost 10 years ago, and I've been doing it since.
Many Eyes was a project at IBM that was like revolutionary, and it recently it closed its doors, I think, in June of this year.
Yeah, from what I can tell, I certainly have been a little bit out of the loop, but it does look that way. It's been through a lot of really interesting evolutions, and it was kind of fun to see and be a part of it, especially in the beginning. When I joined, it was actually being rewritten because it was getting too much traffic and too much attention, and the infrastructure we had couldn't sustain it. It was kind of a research prototype that became really huge. And so we got to rewrite it. And then a lot of the visualizations were written in Java. And as you know, on the web, Java has been a little bit harder to work with. I'm sure many experienced applets that no longer run. And some of them were also in Flash, so the same story. And so by the time that I had left, it was kind of being picked up and moved around to kind of try and actually productize it and turn it into something more real. And I believe that recently it's been transformed to be much more web-friendly, but I don't know exactly the full story behind what the plans for it are. I watch it from the sidelines and wish it well.
Yeah, it looks like as a free service, it's kind of gone away as an individual concept, but now it's IBM Watson Analytics. So it's becoming part of the Watson family of IBM stuff. So hopefully Many Eyes, or the idea of collaborative visualization, will live on.
Absolutely. Yeah, and we've seen lots of exciting projects that have come up. I don't want to say as a result directly, but certainly inspired by that. And a really big surge of that is actually happening in journalism, where we see a lot more interactive visualizations being used as part of traditional storytelling. And those folks need those same kinds of tools. They have data, they want to be able to create graphics really quickly. It can't always be, you know, incredibly detailed and super interactive. Sometimes you just need a small chart to go along with things. And so there's lots of really cool tools that folks have been writing that are open source that companies can deploy and actually use in their infrastructure.
It seems like in my career as a software engineer, data visualization, I think, starts with the pie chart. Like, I know that might offend an expert of software, you know, in this space, but I apologize ahead of time. But, you know, that sense of achievement that one has when they make their first pie chart. But it seems like the ramping up from there is a little bit steep. You know, where's the on-ramp? Do I need to go read books by Edward Tufte to start really thinking about data visualization?
That's a really excellent question. I think Tufte's books are absolutely beautiful. And in terms of just getting excited about the potential of data visualization, they absolutely get you there, because you're going to get to see an overview of really fun historic visualization, and there's certainly lots of opinions just mixed in there for you to kind of start figuring out what your style is. But, you know, I think there's definitely a lot of perceptions around what data viz is, good data viz or not good data viz, whether a pie chart is good or bad. I don't so much subscribe to that, because I think all data viz has its place, and sometimes a pie chart is enough. Sometimes you don't need anything too crazy or much more complicated than that. And so, you know, a pie chart is a great start. A lot of folks come to data visualization from Excel, and a lot of people work in Excel for a really long time, and it's a great tool for a lot of the tasks that people have to do. So, you know, and it provides just enough facilities for you to often make a lot of sense with what you're working with. Mm-hmm. And then it starts getting a little bit more complicated. So if you're realizing that there's certain charts that you're making over and over and over again, and wouldn't it be great if you just had a server and you could pipe that data back and render them on the website to share with everybody instead of sending Excel spreadsheets around, well, that's when you actually start building things a little bit more custom. And there's still even libraries that you could use that are open source that provide some of the basic charting capability that you see in Excel, you know, your bar charts, your scatter plots, your pie charts, things like that. And I think the complexity really comes up when you're starting to realize that, oh, wouldn't it be great if you clicked on that thing and this other thing happened and you saw this other visualization, maybe you wanted to coordinate a bunch of them so that you kind of have this much more robust filtering mechanism. And that's when I think you start seeing people come up with really crazy layouts, you know, a tree map inside of the bar graph, inside of, you know, and those are really fun. But I think, you know, they're also very specific and not everybody needs them.
Yeah, that gap, though, to jump from a static chart or static visualization, something that I, you know, and when I started, I generated these things as PNGs or GIFs on the server side, that jump to interactivity, something as simple as a filter. And it still delights the user, though. Like, if you have a dropdown that then changes something, we don't want to just generate a new graphic. We want it to animate on the way there to give you a sense of change, so adding that dimension of time.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that animation adds a lot to graphs, especially on the web. I think most folks, when they see charts, they kind of expect to be able to at least hover on them, get a little bit more information, but then also interact with them in more interesting ways. And that transition definitely brings with it a lot more complexity, but I think some of the libraries that we have today make it a lot easier. A lot of both charting libraries that have pre-built components try to expose various kinds of events or give you hooks to be able to wire into certain events. And then at the same time, when you're, you know, creating new visualizations using, you know, standard DOM components like SVG, for example, or even divs. I mean, I've seen lots of visualizations just done with straight up HTML, and then, you know, you can use the standard browser event system to really be able to hook in and change things around. So,
So you are the director of data visualization at Boku. And I think that's really significant, because by saying that is your title, by having the title of director of data visualization, it's a declaration on behalf, not just of your company, but as an industry, that this is a specific and valued practice within the practice of software creation. You know what I mean? You're not just like, oh, go ask Irene. She messes with charts over there. This is a very specific skill. And I remember struggling to get a QA department. I think it's so wonderful that there's a formalized kind of like department around data visualization. Is that something that other companies should be looking at?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely think so. It's been a really exciting year for us. I'm almost humbled at the amount of interest that we're seeing from people. But in a lot of ways, it makes sense to me, because we've gotten really good at building software for the web. And because of that, we've gotten really good at collecting data. And the moment you have data, you want to make it actionable. There's no reason not to. You know, a lot of times we make decisions based on our gut feeling, and suddenly we now have data that we can make use of. And as soon as folks try to do that, they realize, oh, this is an entire discipline. Data science, data analysis, they're things that you have to be able to do and know how to do. And once you analyze your data, you want to communicate that in some way that will really enable the conversation and not just leave folks kind of looking at a bunch of numbers and wondering, well, what does that mean? So I think that it's just really very much the next step for a lot of what we're doing. And we see a lot of companies that have implemented this incredibly well. You know, I always talk about Netflix because their entire business model is data-driven. They're a data-first company. They have all your history, all your behavior. And in a lot of ways, they know exactly what it is you're going to watch and what you're going to enjoy. And, you know, when you look, for example, at the programs that they're starting to offer, people love the shows that they put together. And those are very much a consequence of really looking at the data that they have. So I'm really excited to see more and more people understand that and acknowledge that just looking at data and using it both for insight and communication is going to be a really powerful tool in their arsenal.
Where is the intersection of the practice of data visualization at the company versus user experience and then design? Is there like a Venn diagram? See, here I am trying to design some visualization, like, you know, because you've got UX and UI, right? You've got designers and then you've got you. How do you all work together?
Oh, it's the best collaboration ever. I'm so glad you asked that, Julie. So we follow very much a user research driven approach to the way that we work with projects. And a lot of the times that means that during our discovery phase, we will have both a more traditional designer, someone who's doing the user research and persona development, and really understanding what the stakeholders have to say and what they need. And then we also have someone who is working on the data visualization end, but primarily on the data analysis and context gathering and maybe a little bit of prototyping. And so that person will sort of, you know, figure out what's the data that the folks have, what are the questions they need to be asking. Can we answer it with the data? Are the answers we're finding even making sense to people? So there's kind of this back and forth from both ends. And both of these processes inform each other a lot. So, for example, if we know that we want to do a very data-driven interface, you know, we can go and crunch some numbers and then go back to our designer and say, here's what we're finding. Can you, you know, go talk to the folks, see if this makes sense or not? You know, how about we think of these wireframes in this other way? So it's definitely a process that is, I think, has been new to us this year, something that as we've just been building more and more intricate and complex data-driven tools. But we find that it ends up filling both of the gaps in both of our processes so much better. So our designer ends up being much more informed by actual factual data, and we are so much more informed because we have a better understanding of our stakeholders. So that process is something I'm super excited about, actually, and I'll be speaking about it in the Strata conference in I think March of next year. So I'm pretty excited to share more about how we do it.
So it really is quite formal, right? I mean, it's not just like sometimes I feel in small companies, design is the designer is talented and we trust the designer and the designer does what the designer does. But you really are doing, you know, A, B, C through Z testing to make sure that this really is scientifically the appropriate visualization.
I wouldn't say that it's always as rigorous. And I think sometimes it also depends on the complexity of the data that we're operating with. Not all the questions we ask are so complex that we have to do that much testing. A lot of the times, some of our initial gut feelings will pan out to be right, if not the first, then second or third. And we'll kind of go from that. But it's definitely somewhat formalized in that we know when we're missing something, and we'll know that it's really important for us to ask a lot of questions. And we'll do a lot of verification with the folks we're talking to make sure we're on the right track. Obviously, the last thing anybody wants is for us to build the wrong thing. And I think this year was also exciting for us because we really got to see to experience and see the full potential of having kind of a full UX practice versus I think what maybe more traditionally folks consider when they think about web design, which is like someone making their buttons and putting them in the right place. And that's kind of a misconception that we you know are excited to share with people because this design has been such a core part of our practice, and we've built just much, much better products for people. So.
Hey folks, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about Raygun and their new product called Pulse. Raygun is an error and crash reporting software provider, and their new product, Pulse, it's a real-time user monitoring product. It gives you performance data and user insights, lets you understand exactly what's happening when users interact with your software, so you're never left guessing. Raygun provides you with the answers to your performance questions, and they've found over 10 billion, that's billion with a B, bugs in customer apps with their crash reporting product. And now Raygun will help you understand application quality like no one else. Over 30,000 developers worldwide can't be wrong. I use Raygun all the time and I enjoy it very much. You can try it out today with a no-risk 30-day free trial. Start improving your software quality immediately. Try Raygun for free today at raygun.io. So Many Eyes was, I believe, in 2007. So I feel like if we mark that as the beginning of the uptick of the, you know, the hockey stick of enthusiasm around visualization on the net, what do you think, what are some examples of, where data visualization really like got the attention of more than just, you know, the small subculture of data visualizers? I feel like there's the New York Times visualization team, and then Nate Silver's 538 statistics website. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely agree. Both of those institutions have had so much impact on our community, and they continue to. I mean, everyone looks at the New York Times, and they always innovate so fast in terms of just the types of visualizations they make. I've definitely seen that become a more common communication pattern. You know, I'll have, you know, friends who just expect it more. There was recently kind of a very interesting, actually, motion graphic piece that kind of went step through of this really intricate visualization of, I believe it was World War II. And I was really amazed to just see it show up in all kinds of contexts, not just in the data viz community. It was very much talked about in the historian community and other places, and the film community kind of jumped on it. So it was really interesting. No one talked about it as, oh, wow, look at this data visualization piece. And I think that's one of the things that sometimes it may be surprising, but I hope for us, is that people stop talking about us as like this a subfield and just talk about the content that we produce. And I think that ends up confirming itself when you just look at some sort of a data visualization piece and you don't really think about the color or the layout. You actually really dig into the story and kind of forget that everything else was there. And I consider that success for better or worse. But we kind of actually were really lucky this year to produce this project called Stereotropes, which was looking at TV tropes. And we were really interested in the way people were describing tropes that appear in film and other media. And we built this project called Stereotropes, and we got a lot of really interesting conversations from folks completely outside of the technical community, because we talked about gender, and the gender is represented through natural language processing. And it was really nice because it was, you know, fairly unbiased analysis, and we just kind of reported what we saw. And we got all kinds of folks chatting with us from the humanities, from that community itself. We were really thrilled that they were excited about our work. And I really appreciate being able to share this discipline with other people. Digital humanities is one place where there's a huge increase in that. There's good, you know, new events popping up everywhere. Folks who are working in history and geography and things like that are starting to really make use of these tools in some really creative ways. So I watch to see what they're doing.
For people who are listening who might not be familiar with that word, tropes, it's kind of like a cliche that you see repeated time and time and time again. And there's this really wonderful site called TV Tropes that you can go check out. But TV Tropes, the website, as lovely as it is largely kind of a classic text-based wiki. And if you go to Stereotropes, T-R-O-P-E-S, .boku.com, you'll get a much, almost like a viewer of TV Tropes content. But what's so surprising about it is that you look around and you go, this is a pleasantly organized site and it has some nice visualizations. But then you do a mouse over and then suddenly the page just kind of comes to life, and then data starts getting connected in a way that you wouldn't necessarily expect. Words start having lines drawn to them, and then you start realizing that this is a much superior way to explore a wiki of content. It's really an exceptional example that people should check out.
Thank you. That's really kind of you. Thanks.
It's like you see something fresh or new like this and you're like, oh, I want to do that. You know, I want that on my website. I did not expect that. You know, you look like, using Stereotropes again as an example, you know, like, oh, here's a list of a column of, you know, four different tropes, and then you hover over one of them, and then the whole page comes alive, and you're like, oh, wait a second. And then the neurons in your brain start making connections that are directly associated with, like, you've inspired those neurons to suddenly start firing. And then you'll just spend your whole day on the website. It's really pretty fantastic.
That's the chief complaint people have had for us, is that we made it too easy to spend a lot of time there. And we had someone who was on the site for 6 hours, and we just couldn't believe it. And we kind of wondered if they were just, like, left it open, but they were just periodic activity. And, like, that is my favorite user. Whoever you are out there, like, I love you. Thank you.
I hope that wasn't me. I would hate to have someone lose their job because your visualization was too effective.
It's a great problem to have.
So how do you build something like that? Is this D3.js?
Yeah, so we're using D3 for all the different visualizations, and there's some other more MVC-specific components. So we're using Backbone in this case, but we've used various kinds of libraries to fill in those gaps. And then the entire site is actually just a static site. So we, especially for apps that
really?
Don't require...
Yeah, sorry, let me interrupt. It's a static site,
yeah.
But it feels so dynamic.
It is very dynamic. When I say static, I mean that there isn't a backend server that's actually powering any type of queries. What we end up doing in these cases, where we know the data is finite, we know the queries that we're going to make, we actually pre-generate all the JSON data, dump it on S3, and the front-end app just makes requests to that, which is pretty great because you literally couldn't bring it down unless Amazon goes down. And then, you know, that the rest of the internet is out.
So. That's so amazing. I love that we have come full circle, and that a site that feels dynamic, that is dynamic, is at the height of technology here in 2015, happens to be statically generated because the data set is finite. Of course, it's the totally appropriate thing to do for this technology need.
Yeah, absolutely. For things that are read-only in this way, we definitely consider it a lot of times. And in this case, we have kind of a data pipeline that actually goes and gets the data, and that's a whole another craziness. The data is like many gigabytes, and it's in a triple form, and so there's a whole analysis pipeline that we can just rerun, and it'll regenerate all our S3 files and update them. So yeah, it works really great.
So talking a little bit about D3.js, was that another kind of pivot point in the creation of effective visualizations? I mean, there were things beforehand. There was a lot of Java. For a time, only Java was the visualization tool. Like in the early 2000s, if you wanted to see a visualization, you'd show up at a page, the page would pause, Java would load, and there'd be a little island of interactivity. But then it seems like D3.js changed all that.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that D3 really ushered a new era for people making not just charting on the web, but really creative charting on the web. There were certainly predecessors, so D3 came out of the work of Mike Bostock, obviously, who everyone should follow because he just does amazing things all the time. And before that, there were some other libraries, one called ProtoViz. And actually its predecessor was a library called Flare, which was written, I believe in, Flash or Java. But they, started to implement this idea, coming out of what's called the grammar of graphics, where you sort of really break down your visualization into the different components that it contains. So, you identify them as repeatable patterns. So for example, in a scatter plot, a circle is a mark, and you can have lots of different types of marks, and you can have different layers of marks, and then you have axes. And so instead of saying, I want a bar chart, all of those different libraries work by saying, well, I need to have some axes, and then I also need to have bars, and those bars are going to repeat according to this rule, and they're going to be high according to this other rule. And so the power of D3 is actually in that it is very flexible. So it does have some pre-built-in layouts for things like, you know, area graphs, for example, where you can pass the data and it will basically attach positioning specific properties to it. But in a lot of cases, you really can be very flexible with it. So if you decided you wanted to have your visualization be, you know, stars that you position in space according to, by multiplying some data points and translating them to, you know, your SVG element, sure, you could totally do that because that's kind of the main part of D3 is that it's data-driven documents. So you just have that binding really closely together, and then as a result, you can kind of create new types of visualizations. And I think both D3's existence and being so flexible combined with all the amazing work that the New York Times were doing with it. So Mike Bostock was working at the New York Times for a long time and producing really incredible interactives and releasing just hundreds, if not thousands, of examples. So a lot of the D3 community is powered by this website called Blocks. And Blocks are just really shareable pieces of D3 code that render. It's just a GIST viewer, if you will, just our GitHub, small GitHub code snippets. And but what made them great is that lots of people were producing them and basically covering a ton of different examples for the kind of visualizations you would want. So if you needed an example of some crazy diagram, it's pretty likely that you could find it and then just modify it to fit your code. And Mike Bostock has created hundreds of them, so did other people, and tools are being built on top of that to make it even easier for people to find the examples that they need. And so as a result, there's just a huge ecosystem around it.
So Blocks is kind of like CodePen or GIST for visualizations, and you can share them and remix them, and there's even a browser extension.
Yep.
So this is the place that people who are listening, like, they should probably start at Blocks and start learning about how this stuff works.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say you can go to Mike Bostock's page on the Blocks website and just look through his examples and be super impressed and intimidated, and then just look at the code and say, oh, I can do this. And
yeah. Then do it. is one of the things that is most impressive about D3 is the element of time. It's not just doing data binding and presenting a visualization, but the idea that if the data changes, the visualization changes dynamically.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the most exciting but also most challenging parts of D3 is understanding this lifecycle setup. Basically, any kind of element can be in three different states. It could either be entering, as in it wasn't, it didn't exist before in a data set and now it appeared. It could be exiting, as in it is no longer going to be present. And then updated, which is, you know, it's been there and it may have changed or it may not have. And the way that you work with D3 is basically you just specify the instructions for what should happen to those elements at those three different stages. And it's actually pretty cool because that means that no matter how many times your data comes through, you kind of have the set of instructions for what should happen at those points in time. So it takes a little while to kind of wrap your head around it, especially because one of the funky things about D3 is that even though you're working with a collection of elements, like an actual array or something, it doesn't seem that way because you just chain things. You kind of chain things along and it looks like you're working on a single element, but you're not. But once you sort of wrap your head around it, it becomes really easy to be able to add kind of that interactivity. And initially that interactivity, obviously is just, you know, you add things, you remove things. It's still somewhat static, but you can very quickly add transitions to that. And transitions actually let you animate from one point to another. So once you know that you want a point, for example, to appear when it's entering, instead of it just showing up, you can, let's say, animate its opacity. And that is literally just a couple more lines of code. So we started seeing a lot of really exciting animations being added because once you kind of get the basics, you can just layer them in addition to what you have.
Would it be fair to compare D3.js with jQuery in the sense of it was a quantum leap on top of JavaScript and also provided this idea of chained kind of fluent interfaces?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. And actually, when I teach our D3 class, I actually start by comparing the two different libraries because they do actually share some functionality. So you're still interfacing with the DOM. You can still set properties. You can style elements and things like that. And then they kind of diverge in their own directions. And that D3 then adds all this extra functionality for working with visualization. And I think in terms of its significance, it absolutely had the same type of effect on our community whereas before it was something that a select few folks did and it was really hard to do. So you didn't see nearly as many really exciting, really engaging visualizations. It just didn't have as broad a reach. And now it's kind of the de facto standard. You sort of start from there and then, you know, you might decide, okay, I need to work with WebGL or because I have too much data, or maybe I want to work with Canvas. But that is just the starting point for a lot of people now, just like jQuery's.
Do you feel that a good visualization technology is one that lets you focus on the visualization and less on the technology? Or is that, are they impossible to decouple the two?
I think it probably depends on the use case that folks are running into. I think that it is good to have as close a pairing between the technology and what it is you're trying to do. So I think in terms of what D3 offers you, once you get used to it, which mind you takes a really long time, I do want to give folks that warning. It's a hard library. It took me months. It took everybody I know months. Don't give up on it. But once you kind of wrap your head around it, there is very much a one-to-one mapping between what you want to do and the code that you need to write to do it. I would say there isn't too much abstraction layers. There isn't some kind of a crazy magical structure. There's no magic in D3, just about. It's very functional. You pass data in, things happen to it. You create elements, you customize them.
It's very functional. That's almost like a bit of double entendre there. Is it a kind of a functional language of its own? You are thinking about math and about chaining functions together.
Yeah, I mean, you're chaining functions together, but one of the funny things in D3 is that sometimes what you produce is actually more functions that you can pass data through. So an example of that would be using D3 scales, which are a really custom, really useful utility for translating data from one space to another. So the most common use is actually translating your data from your business domain to actual pixels in space. And you can customize these scales. You can say, okay, this is going to be a linear scale, and this is the domain range, and this is the actual visual, you know, the range, pixel range, and I want it to be done in these increments, and things like that. And all that gives you is another function that you can then actually just pipe your data points through, and it'll know how to translate them. And that's another kind of confusing part about D3 is that a lot of the times you're just customizing these extra functions that are then going to be super tailored to what you're trying to do.
So you are also the chair of a conference called OpenViz, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So OpenViz, V-I-S, at openvizconf.com is coming up in April. So it's a two-day conference, a single track, and it's dedicated to the practice of visualizing data on the web. Is this something you think people who are listening should come to?
Absolutely. I'm really, really proud of OpenVizConf. It's going to be our fourth year. And every year we bring together folks who are actual practitioners in this field. And we say, please help our attendees learn how to do what you do. So we're very much focused on having an educational spirit. It's not quite tutorials, but just about. Some folks will go up there and they'll talk about libraries that they use, or they'll dissect a project they've built, or they'll talk about design patterns, and it's really just an incredible set of folks. Every year we run the call for speakers. We're actually right in the middle of our current reviews for next year, and we're just so impressed with everything that comes in. I always want to make it like a month of talks because they're all great. We generally cover kind of the full space from data analysis to data visualization to, you know, working with the newest and most exciting technologies in the web, but also how to bring in this work to your practice and to your life. So the goal is for it to be very, very accessible.
Very cool. It looks like it's accessible also from a pricing perspective. It looks like a great conference. I think that anybody who is interested in the space should definitely check it out at openvizconf.com. Thanks so much for chatting with me today, Irene. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Scott. It's been really great. I'm really honored to be on your show.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.